Well, certainly, gentlemen, everybody applauds the announcement just made by Mr. Nixon. But a more fundamental question, perhaps, relates to what Mr. Nixon himself said, suggesting that we finally have achieved the right kind of peace, a lasting peace. Do you think this is true? Senator Javits.
I do not. True is a very hard word. The prayer of thanksgiving from all mankind makes the coming of peace true. But a lasting peace will take far more than we have yet seen from both the American people and the people of the world. The American people, in my judgment, might easily say, well, we've had our fill of this kind of entanglement. We're now going to withdraw from the world leadership which our power gives us. On the other hand, we might become more truculent and think that force will do it, because the bombing, at least in the near term, seems to have brought an agreement. I hope we avoid both pitfalls, and I hope that in the days ahead we develop the constructive role that needs and can be played to really make this the beginning of permanent peace.
Senator Humphrey?
Well, I think the president laid down certain standards for what he believes will be required to gain a peace that has genuine meaning. When he said, for example, that this ceasefire and this agreement in its terms must be scrupulously adhered to by all parties. And secondly, when he called upon the great powers, and I suppose, as has been indicated here, he really meant the United States, Soviet Union, mainland China, and possibly some others, to exercise self-restraint, mutual self-restraint, which means not to keep pouring in the weapons, to kind of cool it, to act as a cushion and a force for restraint and reconciliation. Then he also, I believe, told us that that the ceasefire agreement will have to be implemented. He didn't spell it out, but implemented with the most careful supervision. I'll be interested to see, as I'm sure we all will be, what that international supervision will turn out to be. I, like others, I'm so grateful tonight for this announcement, and can't help but say that the president's reference to President Johnson in the context of this message was thoughtful, considerate, and the kind of a tribute to the late president that I think he deserved and the American people will appreciate.
Senator Tower, you've been a strong supporter of the administration's Vietnam policies from the beginning. Is there anything about this that concerns you, or do you share this general approval?
I am not concerned, because I believe that the president, in his own mind, and I believe that my thinking is consonant with his, in his own mind, he believes he has achieved a settlement that will result in creating a climate of self-determination for the people of Indochina. And it once preserved the credibility of the United States as a deterrent to aggressive designs on any nation by aggressor powers. I think that it vindicates the patience that the president has shown. Because one thing that we should all understand is the Orientals have a very, very great deal of patience and will wait us out. He has shown patience in the face of tremendous domestic pressures here at home to accept almost any kind of settlement. He has followed his course, sometimes in a very lonely way, and without being able to explain why he's done these things or justify what he's done publicly, as he has noted. And yet he has faced up to this kind of criticism and opposition, and I think we've come out the better for it.
Senator Jackson?
Well, Paul, first of all, of course, this is a night that Americans have been waiting for many, many years. And I want to share and associate myself with Senator Humphrey's comments about Lyndon Johnson. It's just tragic that he couldn't have lived 48 hours longer to see this tragic war come to a final end. Your question related to the question, the lasting peace. I believe that when the history of the negotiations has been written, that the role of the Chinese and the Russians in this will be very interesting. There's no doubt that they played a major part in this final settlement.
Do you have that on reliable authority from your sources in the administration?
Well, I have it on good authority. Let's just stop there.
Can you elaborate any more?
Well,
for us?
What I'm concerned about, if we're going to have lasting peace, it really will depend on the kind of arrangement we have with the Russians and the Chinese regarding the supply and assistance and support to the communist forces, whether it's in Vietnam or in Cambodia or in Laos and so on. Now, that's the $64 question. And that, in turn, is tied up with this balance of effort on the part of the administration and trying to maintain peace in the world with China and with the Soviet Union. There's the nub of it. And if the president, we'll get the bill of particulars tomorrow and the days following.
I can't conceive of the president, however, accepting an agreement like this if he did not think the Russians and the Chinese would honor it in some measure.
Well, I say, but
they would not at least acquiesce to it.
I agree in general, John, but I think we'll want to know what are the arrangements. Is there an agreement? Is it an informal understanding? Will the president be able to say that these two major powers are going to join in supporting the objectives that he's announced? I'm just raising these questions. And tonight, Paul, all we could do is raise questions. We have a general statement, and it covers in a general way the whole story because he's incorporated, the president has by reference, what he said in January and what he said in May, and they've been achieved, he said. So if that's the case, hopefully we have the basis here for lasting peace, provided that the Chinese and the Russians play a major part in supporting those goals.
Well, this raises a related question, namely, will this now help us to achieve new breakthroughs in our relations with the Chinese and the Russians?
Well, let's go back.
They're related. You can't divorce them.
As a matter of fact, I think that the agreement that the president has spoken of tonight is in part due, and maybe in a large measure due, to the prevailing conditions between the United States and the Soviet Union, China and the United States and the Soviet Union.
And
it
Soviet Union
and
China.
Those relationships, it's a kind of a tripod. And the whole future of peace depends on what happens amongst those three.
I'm sorry, but our time has run out all too quickly again tonight. I'd like to thank you, Senators Javits, Humphrey, Tower, and Jackson, for coming here and giving us the benefit of your wisdom as usual. Paul Duke in Washington.
During the fighting in Indochina that the president announced, during the fighting in Vietnam that the president announced, Saturday night, more than 300,000 Americans were wounded. Half of them needed treatment in hospitals. Many of them who needed that hospital treatment are still there, still getting it. One group is at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Houston, and with them is Bill Worrell of station KPRC.
There are about 30 veterans here on the hospital ward in Houston, Texas. They have just heard, along with you, the president's announcement of a ceasefire in Vietnam.
The reaction was a mixed one, but most a happy one. And one is Doug Peterson of the 82nd Airborne from Iowa. Doug, what was your first reaction?
Well, I was kind of shocked at first because they've been dragging this thing on, all these talks. And when I first heard about it, it was a beautiful thing.
Doug, do you think the war could have ended sooner?
Yes, I do. It could have ended a lot sooner.
In what particular fashion, though? The president said he wanted his own terms. He seemingly got them.
Oh, well, you got the politicians, and it seems like that they wanted to drag it on, but they could have sent more troops over, and they could have cleaned the place up. They had it halfway taken over, but then they put restrictions on the troops, and it made it harder for them to carry out what they're supposed to do.
How long have you been here in the Veterans Hospital?
I've been here a month.
How long have you been taking treatment?
A month. And it's really good care. They got a good staff, and they got excellent doctors. And I've been in other VA hospitals before, and I really like this one.
Thank you, Doug. The next veteran we would like to talk to would be Ed Evans. Ed was with the Marine Corps, and he is from Waco, Texas. Ed, you heard the president's speech. What was your reaction?
Well, I was glad to hear the ceasefire. Glad for the people, baby. Just wish it had came sooner, 5 years sooner for me.
Well, Ed, you spoke of POWs. Did you have any friends that were captured?
Yes, one or two.
Do you know of their whereabouts? Have you heard anything about them?
No, I haven't.
Ed, a lot of veterans, you hear the statement of bitter about the war, bitter towards it. What are your feelings about the Vietnam War?
Well, I don't think it should have been started in the first place.
Now you were in it and you had to do a job, right?
Right.
Are you progressing well?
Fine, so far.
Okay, thank you, Ed. We're going to move along now. We have as the next Vietnam veteran, Gary Blankenship from Boswell, Oklahoma. Gary, are you glad we held out for most of the terms? You heard the president. I know you have some reactions. The president said that there were some things that he wanted to clarify, some things he wanted to do, and he seemingly got those. Are you glad for that?
Yes, I'm extremely glad he held out for the peace treaty terms, and I think in the long run it paid off, and I hope that we do get our POWs back within the 60 days. We find out who our MIAs are, whether they're missing or if they are actually dead, and especially for their loved ones. And I think it paid off to hold out myself. And the renewal of the bombing that he started last month, I think it is what actually brought the peace to the tables.
You feel, and you talked about the bombing, of course there was a great reaction throughout the country on the resuming of the bombing. When you were in Vietnam and there was some protest, how did you feel being a veteran fighting the war over there?
Well, I was very upset the way Congress and our so-called allies in the nation didn't stand behind President Nixon on his decision of the renewal of bombing. I think if it would have happened possibly 2 years or 3 years earlier, we might not be over there now. And we would have our men back and several men alive and not injured.
Of course, fighting in Vietnam, you know a lot of the things that a soldier has to go through. Do you think the South Vietnamese Army is prepared to carry on the struggle against communism?
I think so now, after the Vietnamization started in 68. If there is any more fighting to be carried on, I think they should be able to handle it from here with our help and assistance.
How are you feeling and how are you progressing here at the Veterans Hospital?
I feel absolutely wonderful, and I'm progressing best be expected.
Thank you very much, Gary. Gary Blankenship from Boswell, Oklahoma. Next, we have Lewis Helms, and he's from Baytown, Texas, which is right outside of Houston. Lewis, first of all, what was your reaction to the speech, the president's speech of peace?
Well, it sounded pretty good if it works, you know, but sounded too easy to me. All of a sudden, you know, those people just agreeing to those terms all of a sudden. If it works, it surprised me.
Thank you very much. Well, that's about the way it is here at the Veterans Hospital in Houston, Texas. They have heard the president's speech along with you about a ceasefire in Vietnam. The reaction is mixed, but most of all, everyone is happy that peace is finally here. This is Bill Worrell at the Veterans Hospital in Houston, Texas.
For South Vietnam, the end of a generation of war is, so it appears, in sight. Dennis Trout of NBC News Saigon is on the other end of this phone line. Dennis, can you hear me?
Yes.
Dennis, what is the mood in Saigon at this time?
Well, the mood in Saigon, of course, the announcement of a ceasefire has been greeted with great joy in the capital and certainly throughout the country, for that matter. There's not a family in Vietnam suffered a great deal in the war. Hundreds of thousands have been killed or maimed. The number of refugees that have been created only in the last 10 years is set to number something like told the people numerous times not to trust, and he's taken measures to show them that he doesn't trust the communists either. They're certainly prepared for a political struggle. For a struggle, the police and the army are authorized to spot anyone trying to create anarchy or disorderly demonstrations or incite any pro-communist demonstrations. There's a ban on any sort of propaganda, any to induce all the armed forces to desert during the touching ceasefire period can be shot on sight. So this is not considered to be an end to the struggle here, and there's apprehension as to what the next stage will bring.
Dennis, can you tell us this? We have reports from Saigon that there's been very nearly a doubling of enemy attacks in the last 24 hours. Now, does this have any significance?
Yes, it certainly does. It's what has been thought to be the widely heralded land grab attempt, but it's not only taking place on this side, it's also on the government side. The big fighting that took place over the weekend, last weekend, in the Michelin plantation, was initiated by the government. They were trying to penetrate communist strongholds. The forces there that might be attempting to get closer to the capital. There's also some large-scale fighting reported to in Pleiku province in the central highlands, and that's where the communists are trying more control. We also anticipate some fighting on the perimeter of the city. According to some of our best sources here, the communists have increased greatly in the plantation areas the northern edge of the city, on the northeast and the northwest as well, and they're expected to try to enter hamlets and villages and gain population centers before a ceasefire goes into effect.
Dennis, can you tell me this? The president has announced the ceasefire to take effect on Saturday, New York time. It hardly seems possible that truce enforcement units could be in place by that time, or at any rate be in place effectively. Now, what does that mean? Is it really expected that fighting will cease on Saturday?
Well, the government indicates that the fighting will not stop at all. Generally, when they have a point to prove, they trot out documents which they bill as captured documents. The latest set that they've brought before the press indicates that communists have orders to step up their attacks fire period and just prior to a ceasefire period. At the same time, as the fighting in the Michelin plantation indicates, the government is not loath to extend its control wherever possible as well. And it's highly questionable whether the National Control Commission will actually be able to stop the fighting anyway once it is in place.
I see. Thank you very much, Dennis. Dennis Tribe, NBC News, Saigon. The ceasefire, even one that works, leaves pockets of enemy forces scattered throughout South Vietnam. I want to ask John Cochran, NBC News Pentagon correspondent now, just what can be called friendly territory in South Vietnam these days?
Ed, it depends on whom you're talking to at the Pentagon. The Pentagon has not released a map of communist-held territory, but we do have an unofficial map, which is an optimistic view of the areas held by the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. And some U.S. officials swear it's fairly accurate. Then there's what could be called the pessimistic map. Some military officers say the communists have control over vast areas. Though they may not appear during the day, they take over at night and collect taxes. Many areas may be in dispute until either communist or Saigon flags appear after the ceasefire. And the battle of the flags could, of course, escalate into actual fighting. The only certain thing is that while the communists hold sway over a lot of territory, President Tu has the cities, and that's where the people are. Pentagon officials estimate the communists only control about 5% of the population, but those same officials admit that that estimate may be too low.
John, the president told us tonight that American forces would be out within 60 days. Are any of those American units stationed in fighting areas? Are any of them in any danger?
Well, they could be. We just don't know what's going to happen after the ceasefire. Our men could get out actually much faster than within the 60-day limit. But there will be no rush to do that until American prisoners are returned and the missing in action are accounted for. The troops are in all four military regions of South Vietnam. Out of nearly 24,000 troops throughout the country, you can see that the greatest number are in the section which includes Saigon. That, of course, is where the U.S. headquarters is. And not far away at Benoit Air Base, two Marine fighter squadrons are stationed.
John, you also mentioned the prisoners of war. Now, the promise is that they will come out within 60 days, and obviously arrangements have been made to bring them out as quickly as possible. Can you tell us something briefly about those arrangements?
Well, the arrangements, we believe, will take place at Vientiane as far as the pickup point. At this point,
Vientiane in Laos?
That's right. Pentagon officials I've talked to do not believe the pickup point will be made in Hanoi. There are contingency plans for that. American medevac planes can fly into the airport in Hanoi, but Vientiane is the area most talked about. Then, of course, the men would be taken out primarily to Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. They could also go to Guam and Okinawa if on the first plane load, there are just too many for Clark Air Force Base to handle. And they will stay at military hospitals in the Pacific until they're deemed ready to go home. Some men could conceivably be back in the States in about 5 days.
John, there are some people in the studio with you who would like to see some of the prisoners back in France. The wives of three POWs. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Ed, at least we hope their husbands are prisoners, and we'll explain that in a moment. Gene Eaton's husband, an Air Force colonel, has been missing for over 4 years. Evelyn Grubb's husband, an Air Force lieutenant colonel, was captured almost exactly 7 years ago. And Helene Knapp's husband, an Air Force colonel, has been missing since 1967. Mrs. Grubb, even though you know your husband was captured, you're really not certain what has happened to him.
There are unofficial reports that he has died in captivity. So in the next 60 days, which I'll count every minute, I should have a determination for fact.
And that's where we get into the accounting of all the prisoners and the missing in action. Mrs. Knapp, you're an official spokesman for the biggest organization of POW and MIA families, but I know that in your own personal situation, you must be greatly concerned about the missing in action in particular.
I am indeed, John, and this was one of the things that pleased me about the President's talk tonight, was the statement that the terms of the ceasefire would be scrupulously adhered to, because of the 1,900 men that our organization represents, 1,300 of the approximately are missing in action, and we're going to be watching to see that an acceptable accounting does take place.
Well, Mrs. Eaton, I know that as far as your own situation is concerned, you're thinking about the men who are missing over Laos, of which not a lot has been said compared to those who've been missing over North Vietnam.
No, I'm extremely apprehensive. The very fact that no man that has been shot down over Laos has ever been identified. So I'm hoping that when the Pathet Lao sign a treaty or whatever, that they will at least give forth with the names of the men they do hold.
Have you actually went to Laos to try and find out something about your husband?
Yes.
Did you find out anything?
No, but I did fall in love with the country.
Now, from listening to the President tonight, what did you think he was saying about Laos and Cambodia, primarily Laos?
Well, I think that...
Insofar as prisoners are concerned, when he talks about an accounting of all the prisoners, we assume that he means the missing all over Southeast Asia.
I know, but no one has really specifically identified that particular situation. But here is a situation never before, as far as I know, that a group, 300 plus, of men deliberately have never been identified.
Mrs. Grubb at the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Laird said that there would be no rush to get the men back to the States. He said that the POW and MIA wives had said, keep the men at these medical centers in the Pacific until they're ready to come back. We'd rather wait a week or 2 weeks or whatever it takes. Is that right?
That's correct. I think it will be the decision of the man rather than the military when they will come back.
Now, of course, we all hope that all of your men will be returning. And let's talk about those who will be coming back. There will be some psychological adjustments, obviously. Mrs. Knapp, as a spokesman for the POW-MIA organization, is there some advice that you would give to wives, mothers, and other relatives when they first see their men?
Oh, no, John. I think that each of them have been briefed quite thoroughly by the military, and I think that we've been afforded the opportunity to make an individual decision. And the reason for that is, you know, that some of the men have been held much longer than others. Some will be much more seriously ill and have been wounded than others. And so I think it's going to be an individual case and how they react. There's certainly going to be a lot of problems, but we hope to do our part in helping.
Now, How has your organization gotten along with the administration? I know you've had your ups and downs with both the Johnson and Nixon administrations. On the whole, now, you also were a task officer of the POW-MIA group. How have you felt that you've been treated, and how have you felt that the administrations have treated the whole situation?
I think we've been treated very well by the administrations, particularly the Nixon administration. He and Dr. Kissinger have always attempted to be honest with us, to be sincere with us. Apparently, hopefully, the promises he made, especially at the last convention, are about to happen.
Now, at that convention, the president came before you, and he was cheered rather enthusiastically, and he seemed to get an endorsement to continue with the war for peace with honor, as he called it, instead of an immediate withdrawal, and I think that's what the organization wanted. Is that right, Mrs. Knapp?
I think that the organization wanted to have the kind of an agreement that would ensure all of the things that we felt were important, and in his speech tonight he seemed to indicate that all of those things were being satisfied. And I would like to go along with Evelyn in commenting on the integrity that Dr. Kissinger showed as representing our nation. I think that that was not quite brought out enough in our president's talk tonight, and I, for one, feel that he has been very, very attentive to our needs.
Thank you very much. Now back to Ed.
Well, thanks also to those ladies for coming in on what must be a difficult, happy but night, but a night of mixed emotions. We'll be back after this. First, that the North Vietnamese delegate, Lê Duc Tho, the man who initialed the ceasefire agreement with Henry Kissinger, will hold a news conference in Paris tomorrow at 10 Eastern Standard Time. NBC News will bring you that news conference by Lê Duc Tho and other developments as they occur. The interest in that conference, of course, will be to see whether this statement accords precisely with the statement already made with President Nixon. And tomorrow, the details of the ceasefire agreement will be announced, so there may be a good deal more to report. So to repeat, we'll be bringing you that news conference by Lê Duc Tho and other developments as they occur. President Nixon announced tonight not only that there would be peace, but added a word of caution about what kind of peace it should be. One that Henry Kissinger is to hold a news conference at 11 tomorrow morning, Eastern Time. NBC News will carry that news conference after the Lê Duc Tho news conference in Paris, which is to begin at 10 Eastern Time. The war in Vietnam produced many statistics, grim ones. 46,000 Americans killed in action, another 10,000 dead of non-hostile causes, 303,000 wounded, 450 prisoners, 1,400 missing. Financially, the cost was perhaps $200 billion, but that's arbitrary. The figure depends on the bookkeeping method you use. The cost in dead and wounded was, of course, far higher to the Vietnamese on both sides, and if American society was strained and divided by the war, the effect in Indochina was infinitely greater. It can be measured by the destruction of towns and villages and farming land, by the creation of millions of refugees, not only in Vietnam, but Cambodia and Laos. In South Vietnam, the traditional fabric of society was torn apart, perhaps permanently. Was it worth it? Well, that's a question that all of those who took part will have to answer, and those who helped them on both sides. Tonight, it may be enough to say, it looks as though it's over. Edwin Newman, NBC News.
Involved in studying them and checking them, because I don't think really what is said there is going to be as important as what happens. And what may happen, of course, will be possibilities one side or the other, looking to interpret those protocols in the way that they might find advantageous, may present us with another confrontation and problem and danger. And I wanted to take this approach, because much has been said about the very little that the president did say, and thinking about this country, which has been devastated probably in a manner I don't think any other country in all of history has ever been so devastated, including Dresden and the World War II, bombing targets and so on. I would have liked to have had the little statement that we accept the moral consequences of this horrible tragedy, and we will help both all of Vietnam to recover and supply economic aid and try to, in some way, assuage this horrible blight and blotch in our own flag and our own escutcheon. But I wanted to just call attention to one thing which Senator McGovern commented on in Oxford the other day, because I think this is where we really get to the question whether it will be a long-lasting peace, whether in the possible confrontations we'll find again a 10-year undeclared war. And that is the question of whether we really are on the road to one-man rule, where the presidency and the strength that's accrued to itself has so upset the checks and balances that some little confrontation may be reacted to with personal pique by a man in the White House who can then say, bombers, out you go, and we'll settle this with the usual force. And if you read the article or the text of Senator McGovern's speech, I think he has pointed the finger in the area we had better begin to pay attention to. What has happened has happened, and the death and the destruction and the terror is something that we can't undo, except in terms of aid. But what we can do is address ourselves to the problem and the question of how can we prevent this kind of thing again, because the danger is ever present in the kind of situation that will exist in Indochina. And the struggle to make Congress an equal force and an equal balance in our constitutional system, I think, is the most pressing problem today, not to mention the encroachment on the mass media, and even the example on Saturday when the mass media, in handling the question of the demonstration in Washington, I think showed the effect of the White House's intimidation, because I've never seen a demonstration of that size handled with such minimal coverage. And I think that's a sign of the mass media is worrying about the next 4 years and one-man rule. I think that's where we ought to begin to address ourselves.
I'd like to ask one question that occurred as the president spoke, and perhaps you can answer it. If we're to have a ceasefire, why wait till Saturday? If there are 4, 5, or 50 deaths, they seem to be the most needless deaths of all. Why not instantly?
I think I can answer that, but I read on the subway going down the 1954 ceasefire, and it also was to be effective a couple of days hence, and they all synchronized their watches, and they say it must go down to the lowest echelons. Remember that while every United States soldier, or at least every platoon, has a radio, that's not so for the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese and so forth. And I think if you look through ceasefires, World War II, certainly all those in Indochina and Korea and so on, they always give a couple of days. And now why Saturday and not Friday, I don't know. But you can't just do it the minute you initial, because one guy shoots, and he may not have gotten the word, and then the other guy said they violated, and you're off again. So I think it's safer. It's very hard to explain that to the mother of the guy who dies between now and Saturday. But it's safer in terms of a long-term settlement to have a short lead time.
You see, the thing that the thing that I was referring to in my opening comments, that no matter what the details are that come out, will not change, is that if the president had been frank, I don't expect that any president would be this frank, but I'm just suggesting that we understand it from the other perspective than the one we just heard. What he would have said is, at the cost of $175 billion in direct funds, not to mention the inflationary pressures and neglected other needs and whatnot, but $175 billion in direct funds, and at the cost of 60,000, 58,000 American lives, plus another 240,000, 250,000 American wounded, blinded, maimed, perhaps 2.5 million Indochinese, plus 8 million refugees or homeless. At that cost, we would now arrive back at the same square we were at sometime before. That's a simple statement of truth, because we leave, whatever the protocols say, the majority of the territory in South Vietnam in contention with people whom we've earlier said we would not allow to be there. We leave nothing changed in fundamental respect, the nature of the adversary or the alleged aggression that has been the excuse for what we've been doing. We leave a situation in which the most that can be said is that he made minimal advances over the concessions that he wanted by bombing in a way which leaves the other side so perfectly free to feel that any concessions made were made under such duress that the moment the duress ends, they don't need to honor those concessions. And concessions. Let's not kid ourselves. That's one of the things that is so reprehensible about this approach, is to suggest that achieved after the kind of bombing that we did, if it's subsequently violated, proves the bad faith of the other side. It doesn't prove the bad faith of the other side. Let that be said tonight by Americans, that we understand perfectly well there's none of us that hasn't seen a smaller, weaker person tortured and intimidated by a bully to accept an agreement which, when the torture and intimidation stops, the smaller person doesn't feel obliged to honor. And I say tonight, in the face of this agreement, that the other side does not and will not accept the imposition of terms under those conditions as being terms they have to abide by the moment they can violate them. Now, I say that not because I justify violations of agreements, but because I want to understand the hoodwinking of the American people that's involved in achieving this under these circumstances, preparatory to denouncing the other side if it decides that it will not go on living with that agreement. Now, I want to finish where I started. If the security of the American people, if the integrity of some treaty that we were committed to by congressional action, by Senate assent, by due process of law, if the freedom of the South Vietnamese people or any people, if any of these things were involved in what was going on in Indochina, then, of course, the cost would have some validity in terms of what was achieved. But we get back to the fact that the security of the United States was not involved. The laws of the United States were flouted. The Constitution was ignored and was shredded in the process, as Judge Glenn points out, that there was no freedom defended in South Vietnam. There was no aggression committed against South Vietnam by some foreign foe. And that, therefore, the total cost of what we've done to ourselves and to them is $175 billion. 5,000 American casualties, God knows how many Indochinese, and for that there is nothing to show except that we're back to stopping what we in fact never ought to have started. And that's why I say that the time of the broadcast, with all of the celebration that one feels that finally there's a pause at least, the tone of the broadcast is deceptive, because after we leave Indochina, I want to just make one comment on Judge Blinn's point about what has to happen next. When we leave Indochina, if this man thinks that by this performance he can then be free to re-enter when he says a violation occurs of an agreement which he now calls an agreement with honor, which is an agreement which in its outlines, no matter what the footnotes are, is an agreement he denounced as treachery 4 years ago. But if this agreement is then violated, and he thinks then that because he was elected in November, he became the autocrat of all the Russias, congressional approval without approval of the population to re-enter the war, then of course we are in a situation which Judge Glenn describes, and I think the next thing that has to happen, now that he's announced it's a peace with honor, is to say, fine, we'll take you at the most optimal hope, which is that you're finally doing what George Aiken said to do years ago, which is to announce we won and leave. If that's what you're doing, you're 4 or 5 years late, but it's done. And then to have the Congress enact in the foreign aid bill this year what we've been discussing for the last 3 days in Washington, and which I think the Congress is ready to enact now if the public interest will keep up, which is a statement that under no circumstances will any American funds be used or any American personnel be engaged in any form of combat anywhere in Indochina without the prior consent of the Congress under the Constitution of the United States.
Anywhere in the world?
Well, we're going to have to first make Indochina.
Okay.
We can be a little bit more
okay.
greedy about it later, but let's start with that. So that it's perfectly clear that there is not going to be a temper tantrum in the White House leading to the destruction of everything that's been supposedly put together now, the first time that the other side says, well, we are not, in fact, going to go on with this agreement as if it's been imposed by consent. And I think that's the whole question that anyone that defends this agreement has to live up to. What happens if this agreement's violated? Do we go back to the
agreement? WMCA New York, Dr. Lowenfeld.
I wanted to answer a couple of things that Al Lowenfeld. I think I should preface it. I'm not a Republican. I don't want to defend the Nixon administration. To the extent I was in the State Department, I left in the middle of 66 when it was clear that that was only a disaster. There wasn't much an insider at my level could do about it.
But my comments are not aimed at you know that.
Having prefaced that, I want to seem to respond to two of the points that Al made, and he made a lot of interesting ones, and I'm sure we'll talk about them more. In terms of what will happen, it's quite interesting. If you look at the agreement to the extent, not just that he announced it today, but that it was announced in the Kissinger and Hanoi press statement in October by being 60 days, having 60-day deadlines. One is the release of the prisoners, civilian and military prisoners, held anywhere in North or South Vietnam, and the withdrawal of the American troops. Those are linked at 60 days. And I would predict that those will come about. That is, there will be no significant violation. And during those 60 days, there won't be reintroduction of arms by either side. The prisoners will come home. The troops will come out. All the rest is rather vague and not limited. We're not sure who's going to supervise. We're not sure when, if ever, there'll be an election and who are the candidates and for what territory there is. All those things, I think, as you look, will gradually deteriorate in a muddled way, not in a clear-cut way. And I suspect the president, though he won't say it because of his views of communicating with the world and with his own country, I think the president, though, quite smart enough to realize that it'll all be so vague that at no given point can he be said to have broken his word, and on the other hand, at no particular point will he be forced to go in. And I would bet anything that with or without the kind of resolution you propose, if we get through these 60 days, we're never going back to Indochina in your and my lifetime. I'm not a prophet, but I think that much is pretty clear, and he really didn't say I won. He just said, now just one other point, if I can make Al said, after all, the North Vietnamese can say we didn't really agree because we signed under duress because of the bombing. Now,
excuse me, that's not quite what I said. What I said is, I don't want to derail your comments, but I do want to stress what I said clearly. I don't say they're going to say we signed under duress. They're never going to admit that. What is going to happen is that the agreement in due course will break down into the muddled circumstances you've described. Their interior reasoning is going to be that this agreement has no bearing on them because of the fact that it was signed as it was signed, and that interior reasoning isn't going to be announced because they're not going to admit they break the agreement. I don't think we should confuse what their rhetoric is going to be publicly any more than I confuse what Nixon says publicly with what his interior reasoning is, and I think it's clear that if you're gamble, just this last thought on your comment, if you're gambling that we're not going to go back in, you, of course, I think would agree that anything we can do to increase the likelihood that your gamble is correct is in the interest of your gamble. So you would join us then in suggesting there be a prescription on going back in just to be sure that you win your bet.
I might want to think about that longer. I just want to finish the point about the bombing. Now, what the administration says, and I've talked to some of the lower-level people who are sort of have no particular axe to grind, is that the agreement that we had in October was ready to be signed early November when Kissinger and Haig came back from South Vietnam, from Saigon, and then the North Vietnamese made a variety of objections, and when they put one down, another one came up. I have no way of proving that, but if it turns out that the agreement that we'll see tomorrow, whenever it's published, is the same as the October draft, then that may lend some credence to the statements out of Washington. That is to say, not that they got concessions out or hardened the American attitude by means of the bombing, but that the North Vietnamese, after the election and for whatever reasons they had, decided to change the deal, and the bombing made them go back to the original deal. We don't know yet. I'm willing to wait on that one.
Wait. It's interesting. Do you think you'll know when you see? Don't you think that it's entirely possible that, in fact, what happened is the opposite, that the pressure of the demonstration, the protests, the rising feeling in Congress, which reached the point of the Republican conference being in a position to say they're not going to support funding, that the president suddenly discovered that he better go back to what he was, in fact, violating?
It's quite possible. But all I would like to know, and I'd like to see some congressional committee or whatever before we have resolution, I'd like to put side by side, and it may be footnotes, it may be protocols, I'm not sure how we'll specifically determine, but see what really happened between October and now.
What I said before is what you're demonstrating. People will be taking apart the protocols and arguing about this aspect, that aspect, I say that. It's a waste of time, and it's a lot of nonsense. What will happen is what you said earlier, this muddled business, which will make eliminate the problem of confrontation in a clear-cut way, yes. But your optimistic statement and your faith that it won't happen again, I agree with Al 100%,
It's our obligation to make sure that no president has that option.
Well, that's what
he wishes to take.
Dr. Lonefeld, I'd like to ask, what was the status under Dean Rusk vis-a-vis this agreement? Weren't things pretty much the same?
Well, I don't
Could
think
not
so.
That agreement have been made then?
My recollection is, though I have to say I left the government in 66, and I'm not sure, well before the Tet Offensive and so on. My recollection was that the position of the Johnson administration was a ceasefire and withdrawal of all North Vietnamese troops north of the DMZ, whereas the significant concession that Nixon made, leaving all the rhetoric about honor and so forth aside, in May of 72, he set a ceasefire in place, realizing that if you look at the map, it's half white and half gray. That was the significant change, and I don't think the Johnson administration was ever for that. There was some
right.
mumbling during the 68 campaign, but Johnson never agreed to that.
Well, that's right. It's an agreement which, from this point of view, is weaker than what Johnson would not have taken 6 years ago. That's the point I was making when you say you're good. That what we've done now is, after 6 years of extraordinary waste of life and
Full
money,
circle.
Is to arrive back at a point which was not acceptable 6 years ago from where we were then, and that's what makes the whole thing such an enormous irony of disaster for us, as well as for Indochina.
Of course, one other big difference.
Exactly.
When did Senator Aiken make a statement about, let's give a parade, march out, and say we won?
About two years ago.
No,
I think.
No,
it was
before
longer
I was in
that.
Congress.
It was longer
67.
Than
67.
66,
67,
yeah.
No, I think this is an interesting discussion as to what we could have gotten a number of years ago, what we couldn't have gotten. I don't think it's terribly relevant, because even if we got 10% more or 18% more, I think it's irrelevant, because
well,
the whole thing...
Or
10% less. Well, irrelevant, because nothing was worth it to start with. So it doesn't make that much difference in my mind whether something was done and we got something more. I think the real discussion that we should be having tonight is, what are the seeds that got us in there? Are they still present? Is it enough to say let's try to give Congress the power so that the president has to get their approval? Congress really hasn't performed any great shakes up until now. I don't have any confidence in them. And I don't think that's the institution itself which caused it or which can stop it. I think there are deepest seeds in this country that really have to be analyzed. And unless we do that, we're going to slowly find ourselves in another one of these situations.
Let me ask you this. Isn't it important for us, if we're discussing Nixon's broadcast, to point out that the minute it's finished, that when he says what he said, he is in fact deceiving again? Because I think the seeds of the future lie in terms of the public perception of what was achieved. And I think, therefore,
yeah.
it isn't irrelevant to point out that we are, in fact, not getting what he calls peace with honor, that we have, in fact, wasted,
yeah.
even by the standards that this administration set.
Yeah, I agree that that's important. I think we pointed that out.
Yeah,
I think that's why I regret
you're saying
honor.
It's not important to show that, because that's the beginning of wisdom about what deception... You see, it's a harsh thing to say that the president, the night he announces a ceasefire, is deceiving. I'm aware of the fact that all of us are in public life, and we're all aware of the fact that language is important as a communication device and can be used against you. And I thought very carefully about whether I wanted to say on this night, at the beginning of this discussion, that there was deception. And then it struck me that it was, in fact, cowardly not to say what is the truth, because in the euphoria over the agreement, there's going to be a temptation not to point out that the speech announcing it was shredded, was cloaked again in the same deception. And I think the essential ingredient of that deception for the ordinary citizen to understand is that he did not get what he said he got tonight, and that he got tonight less than what could have been gotten without the enormous loss of life and money years ago. Not because we should ever have been there. Of course, Arnie's exactly right that the price wouldn't have been worth it 5 years ago either. But it's this additional 5 years that he's pretending tonight has produced finally this great triumph of peace with honor, that the American people weren't yelling for appeasement and all that stuff that he was talking about tonight, that they stood up firm for this peace and now they can be proud they got it despite the nervous bellies. It's important to show the fraud of that statement
well,
tonight.
I don't care about the rhetoric. I mean, I think, of course he used rhetoric, and so you'll see tomorrow's paper, Hanoi will say some statement and it'll look as if they won.
President on the same level as Hanoi, the statement of where we've gone.
I think the point is,
he said
two things.
Aside from what
he
said.
One thing
at a time, gentlemen.
Sorry.
Dr. Lona.
Analysis of President Nixon's Supreme Court nominations on the